at dinner. I won't bore you with the details. But Dick said, we always have some kind of technical problem. So I actually brought two computers, believe it or not, and three adapters and two power adapters. Still have trouble. So I've got it on two different things here. But what I want to do tonight and tomorrow, tonight is the kind of general summary of what I think has happened since March of 2020. Why I think it happened. So it's sort of the diagnosis of what happened and why I think it happened. But it's tomorrow that we're going to get into the details. And so I want to tell you a little bit about this book, The Price of Panic, because it was not anything I had planned to write. Just so you know my background, I'm a shameless generalist. I'm a philosopher that writes about a lot of different things, but really interested in economic policy and how it affects human beings. But I have avocational interests. And so in January 2020, I had a new book that came out called Eat, Fast, Feast, about fasting. So this has nothing whatsoever to do with politics. It's just, if this is what I normally do, it was this book. And that's what I was thinking about. It came out in January, and Lent was happening, and I was talking about fasting. And then all of a sudden, we heard about this virus from China and all these sorts of weird things. And I have a particular interest in the misuse of predictive computer models to guide policy. And I say misuse because we'll talk more about this later, but predictive computer models can be really valuable if they're used properly, if they are tested against the actual evidence. But a computer model, it's essentially a complicated sort of argument. You can think of it as an argument in a bunch of, well, if this happens, and this happens, and this happens, and this is true, and this is true, and this is true, then this will happen. So that's sort of how it goes. And the problem is that by itself is not evidence, any more than me just giving you an argument by itself is not evidence, unless the argument's based on something in reality. And I got really, really worried in March when I realized that globally, policymakers were about to make major decisions based upon what turned out to be a single untested computer model. And because I'm interested in this for other reasons having to do with climate stuff, I thought, okay, this is going to be a catastrophe. I don't know a darn thing about SARS-CoV-2 virus. I don't know about COVID-19. What I do know is that they don't have the data to be able to be making decisions based on a computer model. And so I thought, that's a disaster. I don't really know what I'm going to do about it, but that was sort of my opinion. And so I did what anyone who's on the internet would do. And so I just sort of ranted about it on Twitter. You know, I mean, it's kind of all you can do is rant into the ether. I have a friend named Doug Axe, who is a friend from the Discovery Institute. He now teaches at Biola University. He's a really smart guy, PhD from Caltech. Another friend named William Briggs, with a PhD in mathematical statistics from Cornell, who has been involved in a lot of this computer modeling stuff. And so independently, we hadn't talked. We were all sort of simultaneously worried about this very thing. And Doug called me, and it was during spring break, and this was sometime in March, I don't know. He said, Jay, I know that you've been thinking about this, and I'm following what you're saying. And he said, so tell me what you're thinking. And I sort of described it. And he said, you know, somebody really needs to write a book about this really quickly so that this, at least we can have an interpretation about what happened and maybe not do it again next year. And I said, absolutely, somebody needs to write that book. So let me know when you find out who's going to do that, because I'm busy and it's not in my schedule. And so I thought, okay, great. Well, he'll do that. And then I hung up. And then I can tell you when you're an author, things get in your head and you can't get rid of them. And so I started thinking about how this ought to go. And I thought, you know, if William Briggs would join the project, because he's the real statistician, and then if somehow we could get a publisher that would publish it quickly, I could see how this would sort of work. And I talked to Briggs, and he's, I'm game. In fact, I'm trapped in Taiwan for the foreseeable future. So he had literally gone from New York, where he lives, to the island country of Taiwan. China doesn't allow us to call it a country, but it's a different country, all right? And he was doing medical statistics, believe it or not, just sort of as a consultant in Taiwan. Got out of New York, and then got trapped because he couldn't get back to New York. And then I suddenly had all of my speaking gigs for the next 5 months canceled because of the lockdowns. Doug did the same thing in California. His classes got canceled, went online. Well, that frees up a lot of time. And so believe it or not, I'm one of the rare people who actually benefited from the lockdowns. My daughters were home from school, working online. I liked that. I liked my children in the house, right? And that drove them crazy. I didn't have to go anywhere. I didn't have to shower. I didn't even have to put pants on for about 3 months. So we had several things fell into place. I thought maybe we're supposed to do this. And so I contacted Tom Spence, my friend is the president of Regnery Publishing. So Regnery publishes a lot of conservative books, and they have the ability to turn books around in 6 weeks to 3 months, which is, if you talk to a publisher, they say it's a year from the time you turn in the manuscript until it's released. It's just, that's how long it takes. And they said, okay, we think that this ought to be done. Within a week, we had a book proposal accepted, and we're writing the book, and it was April the 1st. And so that's how this happened. I will never, ever do this again. Someone here, we're in open carry state, shoot me if you hear about me trying to do this again. But the only way that it could happen is that literally all three of us were locked down for 3 months and hardly left, and you can get all the information you need if you know what you're doing online. PubMed is available and basically free. So for all the irritating things about social media and the internet, it made it possible to do this. And the lockdowns actually freed up a bunch of time for us to be able to write the book. And so that's how it happened. Three people with different expertise. The purpose of the book was originally going to be called What Just Happened. Because Regnery said, we'll get this out in October. And we thought, well, okay, it's March, April. By June, everybody will figure out that this is insane to lock down and to tell half the population their jobs are inessential, and to tell pastors and priests they can't have church. And everybody will figure that out in June. That's what we thought, right? So very optimistic. And so in October, and the publisher, Regnery, said, this is what's going to happen, is in October, we hope it's not old news by then, because it'll be so far after the lockdowns that it'll just be a sort of, you'll be explaining what had happened a few months ago. Well, as we all know, that's not what happened, right? We've got a rolling barrage of rationalizations and justifications for lockdowns. And if you were paying attention carefully, you'd notice that the argument kept changing to justify the same preferred policy, but the argument sort of kept changing. And incidentally, that computer model, as we'll see in a minute, collapsed almost immediately. As soon as anyone could get into the details, we realized it was a complete mess. But the policies had happened. And so it ended up, we changed the title. We said, okay, let's call it The Price of Panic, because that's really what it's about. We wanted to, one, assess the policies that were pursued to figure out, okay, what evidence was there that they would work? Right? So when I first started talking about this, people viciously attacked me for saying, how dare you criticize lockdowns, because you obviously don't care about people. And I said, now look, if you told me, okay, there's a virus coming, and so we all have to stand on our left foot and touch our nose and burn incense, it would be rational to say, does that make any difference to the virus, right? And in the same way, it's a perfectly rational question to say, do lockdowns, one, do we have evidence, prior evidence, that those help respiratory virus pandemics? And two, once we've tried it, what is the evidence that they actually work? And so we knew we could talk about the first question, and y'all are going to be depressed when you find out what the evidence was that lockdowns were. And then we hoped we would have enough evidence by June or July, when we had to turn in the final version of the manuscript, to at least be able to assess tentatively if the lockdowns actually made a difference. Now, I'll tell you what we thought. We assumed going in, this was the working hypothesis, was that the lockdowns would probably benefit somewhat, that is, they would reduce the spread of the virus somewhat, but that the costs would be greatly exceeded by the benefits. That's what we were expecting. We actually discovered something even more depressing than that. But when you're sort of thinking about any public policy, including a public health policy, to figure out the price of something, in this case, what you're doing is you're weighing the costs and the benefits, and what you want is for the benefits, obviously, to exceed the costs. This is not rocket science. It turns out it's kind of hard to calculate some of the prices of these things, but that's what we wanted to focus on, and we thought, okay, we can't stop it the first time, but at least we can do our part to kind of awaken people to what has happened, why it's happened, what we need to do the next time so that it doesn't just keep happening. I did not expect that in September of 2021, we would still be kind of in the thick of things. Now, in Montana, things are maybe a little different than they are in Washington, D.C., but I can tell you in D.C., what happens is that, you know, in my case, the gym gets closed, and so you don't get to go to the gym for a few months, and then they open the gym, but you have to wear masks, and you have to be at a certain distance, and there's a limited number of people that can go to the gym, and these sorts of things. And then it opened up for a couple of months, everybody got used to that, and then they went back. Right, so we're wearing the stupid masks again. It's all happening, and I thought, okay, what's the end game here, and when is this ever going to end? And what were the criteria ahead of time for determining whether this made sense or not? And it's very, very hard to get an answer to that question. And so I think there's actually a heck of a lot more going on here than meets the eye. And when people look back 50 years from now, if the world is still here, they will not be talking about this remarkable virus. That will not be the discussion. The discussion will be about something else. And in fact, if you look at the history of the 20th century, the coronavirus named SARS-CoV-2 is comparable, it's very comparable to the Asian flu of 1957 and 58. That's probably what it's like. It's not just kind of your ordinary flu, it's a bad flu, but most people that were around in 1957 and 58 don't even remember that, right? So that's how it didn't really make a blip globally like this one. Nevertheless, 2020 is absolutely a historical inflection. So just as the Black Death in Europe was an inflection point, the birth of Christ, in the 20th century, you know, in American history, it would be what, the Revolutionary War, maybe the War of 1812. Well, I can't ever remember what even happened then, but it's called the War of 1812, so something happened, right? Civil War, right? And then what? Maybe World War I and World War II and some things like that. And then more recently, the financial crisis or something. Well, I think that 2020 it's about like World War II in terms of its sort of world historical significance, because it was utterly global. In fact, it's probably the first ever global simultaneous social contagion. That's our interpretation, is that that is what we have been living through. There have been social contagions for as long as there have been human beings. So what is a social contagion? Well, you know, because of what God created us, right? He created man, and then he said it's not good for man to be alone, so he creates Eve, and then he tells them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. We are intrinsically social creatures. It is not good for man to be alone. We are defined both by our relationship with God and by our relationship with our fellow human beings, right? And so that's for good or for ill. We can do good things together. We can also build the Tower of Babel together, right? I mean, that's a fundamental part of being human, is being social. And when that goes wrong, what happens is that just as we can spread a respiratory virus to each other, we can spread ideas to each other and become seized by that idea. So in some ways, we lose our ability to reason. So if you study the Salem witch trials, for instance, you'll see, and in this case, it's actually a group of teenage girls. So for some reason, I don't know why this is, but teenage girls tend to be highly sensitive to this, kind of social contagion. There's a very important new book out, it's not the topic we're talking about tonight, called Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreer. It is about the social contagion of gender dysphoria among young teenage girls. It's massive social contagion that's happening, almost certainly because of social media, in which lots of girls who show no inclination or evidence of being gender dysphoric. So gender dysphoria means that you feel uncomfortable with your biological sex. That's the term. This happens. It's a very rare psychological condition. Mostly happens with boys. But in the last decade or so, it's happened an insane amount among teenage girls. Let me give you one example. In the UK, decade over decade, starting in 2007, the increase in gender dysphoria among teenage girls has gone up 4,400%. 4,400%. That's a social contagion. And so we're living through that now. If you don't, you know, depending upon your stage in life, whether you have teenage girls and are on social media, you may or may not be aware of that, but it is unbelievable. That's a social contagion. And when this happens, we tend to think of ourselves as rational creatures, and we are. Aristotle said we're rational animals, but we can also be irrational. And our friends can help us to think clearly and give us discernment, but they can also, they can infect us with ideas. Now what happens when the entire human population is roughly, but in a sense directly connected to each other, roughly the speed of light, and has HD video available 24/7 directly to our retinas? So now all of a sudden it's actually possible for some kid in Shanghai with his phone to videotape an old man that falls over, passes out on the street during the beginning of the coronavirus, uploads it to the internet. 2 hours later, it's on CNN and all the social media, and everyone that sees it thinks this coronavirus out of China is so deadly that you just drop dead in the street. Right? Now that can only happen because of a set of technological conditions that allow it to happen. And 100 years ago, you could have social contagions, but they were isolated, in isolated pockets. And one famous one was the Dutch tulip mania, in which there was basically a stock market for tulips, and the price went up, and everybody was crazy for tulips, and the whole thing crashed. But it was in the Netherlands, right? It's like this little sort of pocket, so it was contained. But in 2020, we had the first time where we had the preconditions for a global social contagion. Now, I don't think anybody planned it, because I think it's too complicated for a human to have actually planned. But I do think that people, having seen it happen, realize, okay, this is an amazing opportunity to do things that we might not have imagined that we could have done until we saw this happen. In fact, I'll give you examples of influential people who said exactly that, who said, this is a remarkable opportunity for us to transform global civilization, right? Now, these guys aren't that smart, and so they didn't have the power to have this happen, but they're smart enough to recognize a crisis and an opportunity when they see it. And so what we have to do is we have to basically retroactively figure out, okay, now we're going to diagnose what happened, why we fell for it, why it was so powerful in a way that certain other things were not, and how we avoid having it happen again, and what we need to do to prevent it from happening again. Right? That's, I think, what I hope that we will conclude with. But tonight, I just want to give you my interpretation of what happened. So in July of 2020, so this is about 4 months into the lockdown. So if you sort of, let's start this at March the 1st. Of course, if you remember the details of 2020, President Trump, in late January, actually restricted travel from China because of news from this. And it was actually on the advice of Senator Tom Cotton, told him this. And he said, okay, I don't know what this is, but let's restrict travel from that part of China. He was attacked for being a xenophobe and all these kinds of things, right? At the time, that was January the 30th or so. And then the lockdowns happened in March, right? So 4 months after that, this COVID opinion tracking poll asked Americans what they thought the percentage of Americans that had died of COVID-19 up to that day was. All right, so if somebody asks you, what percentage of the American population do you think has died so far after 4 months of this? And so the average guess, this in your head, let me give you a second to guess what you sort of think people guessed. So this, we'll give you the average. All right, so the average, this is the average guess, 9% of the population. All right, and so that's the average. So that's sort of the number that if you ask 1,000 people, they would converge on. So some people is a little above that, some was below that.
So millennials must have been taking.
Yeah, exactly. So there are lots of millennials and Gen Zs, obviously, so answering this. And so I bet they were way up above 9%, right? Arithmetic. I mean, it's past eight. Yeah. I mean, because now, see, the thing is, if I'm pretty sure I didn't get asked this question, but then if I did it, I would at least know the population of the United States and would have remembered the numbers within a few orders of magnitude, right? Like, well, how big I had heard and not gotten anywhere near this. So here's the number, according to the CDC at the time.
It was 0.06%. So I'm not going to make you do math. So that is 150 times smaller than the average guess. So the average American thought that the coronavirus, now I'm not saying, so please nobody ask the questions in the Q&A, are you saying that COVID-19 is not dangerous for anyone? I'm not saying that at all. What we're trying to figure out is how dangerous it is, right? Because it did kill people. That's a significant number of people for 330 million, right? It's just that it's 150 times smaller than the average guess. So here's the question. Where did Americans get the impression that the virus was 150 times more deadly than it actually is? So were they reading The Lancet and going to the CDC charts and analyzing these? No, of course not. They're looking up there on the top right hand of their screen on Twitter, which is what I do. But I fortunately know, I think, what does Twitter want me to think today, right? But most people, that because I'm telling you, this is the CDC number. So I'm not, this isn't my esoteric number that I made up, right? That's the CDC number. So it tells you that no one was bothering, and it takes about 5 minutes to noodle out that number. But almost everyone's views on this are almost entirely determined by what they get in the media. Almost entirely. Now, very sophisticated people think that they have read the scientific literature because they listen to NPR on the way to work, right? And that's just the same thing, right? And I know people like this, and they're absolutely certain. And I said, where did you hear that? But this is what was weird about this, is that you can actually get official government numbers. So it wasn't like there was a dispute. So you could just accept the official government numbers, even though there were problems. And there was a massive gulf between that and what people were actually hearing in the media. Now think of the word media. It means between, right? So the media is sort of, it's between you as a media consumer and whatever it is that they're reporting on. So what should the media's responsibility have been? Surely it should have at least been, okay, it's our job to make sure that the American people have as accurate as possible an understanding of what this is so that they can make a judgment given the details of their particular life. But with almost no exceptions, none of them actually thought that was their responsibility. They thought their responsibility, either they didn't have a responsibility, or they thought it was actually something else. That's the only way that I've been able to figure out how to explain this, right, is massive amounts of panic porn that were bombarded with for months and months on end that could have led to this impression. And so that's at least a third of the story right there, is the institutions that mediate the information were full tilt committed to the panic narrative and not to the preparation and analysis and thinking narrative. And that, I think, actually sort of sets us up really well for this question. What caused the panic in the lockdowns? Now, a lot of what we heard about the effects of the pandemic, when you actually tease them out, you do have to figure out, okay, what would be the effects of the pandemic? So for instance, what if we had responded in 2020 the same way the United States responded to the Hong Kong flu in 1967 and 68, and the Asian flu in 1957 and 58? Well, there was a real cost to that. Or the Spanish flu, for instance. So Spanish flu in 1917 may have killed 50 million people globally, and remember the population is much smaller then. So huge numbers of Americans that went to World War I died of the Spanish flu, not from any kind of ordinary war death. Okay, so that was hugely significant. One of the, probably, you know, the most significant thing that happened in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. And did you know we have no record that we can find of the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, even mentioning it in his speeches? So that tells you how much it's something that significant that still didn't really figure prominently in the politics of the day. And so for us, we had to actually use those numbers to try to figure out, okay, how much would this have cost if we hadn't locked down, if we hadn't forced people to stay home, if we hadn't done all these things, and say, okay, that would have been the cost, and then everything else ends up being the cost of the response itself. And so a lot of the things that we think of as a cost of the pandemic end up being actually the cost of the policies that we chose to pursue, unfortunately. So what caused this? Well, it's what you want to do and what the mind wants to do is to come up with the simplest explanation that you can think of. Albert Einstein famously said, you want your theories about the world to be as simple as possible, but not too simple. So in other words, you'd like a theory that's pretty simple and can explain everything, you know, in terms of kind of one explanation. But if it's too simple, then you have to cram everything into a box and there are things you can't account for. And that's what I think, what we want to do, the most satisfying explanations is one evil guy orchestrated this whole thing. Right, and so that's the kind of ultimate story. If I can have one evil guy orchestrating the whole thing, that's sort of satisfying. That's the simplest possible story, right? But it doesn't submit to that. And usually those stories don't work because there's just nobody's really very smart to pull things off. And so usually the events are too complicated. And so what you actually need is, okay, what three or four things together best explain most of what we want to explain? And so they call this multivariate analysis, or that's a fancy way of just saying there are several things that came together and caused it to happen, right? So the trick is to sort of get those right and in the right order. So I think it's several things. Here's the first thing. It's just all things being equal, the origins of this virus are scary. So I just mentioned the Asian flu and the Hong Kong flu. There was another biggie, the plague. Want to know where that came from? Same basic place, right? The swine flu, you know where that came from? Same basic place, right? Now, I don't know why that is, but there have been several deadly viruses that have come from the Asian subcontinent, right? And that's how you end up with this name, because that's where it came. Now, they don't all do that. There's one that is actually named for the Middle East, right? The Spanish flu is called the Spanish flu because that's where it touched us, but it didn't probably actually originate in Spain. And so just right off the bat, we have this kind of historical memory that there are scary viruses that sometimes come from China or from Asia. And so that was scary. It was also scary because it wasn't just that it came from the place where scary viruses have come before. It came from the People's Republic of China, which we know to be closed. With respect to the information that they give us, right? So they tend not to be as forthcoming as you might like them to be about the details. So that's sort of scary. And that is exactly what happened. Now, where did this come from? Well, for those of you that maybe don't remember the details, right? So Wuhan is a city in the central part of China that is often called China's Chicago. It is an industrial center with many, many millions of people. Highly populated part of China. And do you remember the story remember the media story about where it came from in Wuhan initially? Wet market, right? Now, most of you probably never even heard the phrase wet market before, unless you've been to China, right? It's like, I don't talk about wet and dry markets. What is that? I happen to know because I've been to China, and so wet markets they're exotic by American standards, I can see. Then basically, the animal will be alive, you know, 15 seconds before you get it, so it's really fresh, you know? And in fact, I was in Kowloon, which is across Victoria Harbor from Hong Kong some years ago, and this is the freshest meat you could possibly get. And so you see the fish, and they're sliced this way, and the heart's still beating. So that is fresh, right? This isn't that frozen stuff that they have to bring to Montana from the ocean, right? This is fresh. And so then I went to the next booth. This is a booth in the street, right? And so you go to the next booth, and it's chickens. And so you see the chickens there still in feathers, and there's a woman right over there with a trash can, and you know what she's doing? Chicken farmer, she's killing the chickens. So it's very fresh. And then there's the pigs, and it goes, and this is how this goes. And I can tell you that there was even a beef section in this one-way market. So that is how fresh this is, and it's in the middle of just a huge, thriving metropolis. And so when I heard this initially, and all the media said wet market, right, simultaneously. Now that itself is suspicious. They all said wet market. Why is that? Now think about it for a minute. I just told you that story about the wet market, right? Now, for Americans, that sounds kind of scary. And so if you were wanting to make up a story about where the virus came from that you can sell to Westerners, wouldn't you want to appeal to their prejudice about Chinese ways of doing things? Right? Oh, yeah, those scary wet. Oh, yeah, that must be it, right? And then you don't ever think about it anymore. So immediately I thought, that sounds like it was somebody made up that story to appeal to our, our sort of sense that that's kind of a scary thing. It didn't make any sense to me from the very beginning, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but that was the official story. The fact that it was the official story, and that the obvious secondary hypothesis was supposedly a conspiracy theory, instantly. So it wasn't like, okay, we analyzed the evidence and we finally decided, yeah, it came from this pangolin here in the wet market. It's just that it was like 2 seconds. Well, there is this Wuhan Institute of Virology that's right by these markets. But nope, that was a conspiracy theory. It's definitely from the market. The fact that that was decided so quickly to me was suspicious. And so when we wrote the book, we thought, okay, what can we do here? Well, there was an article that came out in Nature that gave the analysis of the genome, all right? And so at the time, there was a bunch of stuff that we did not know. And I'm happy to say that we said in the book, as you'll see, that we thought it probably leaked from the lab. And that we were willing to say that even when it was insane to say that, or officially insane, because it just made the most sense. There is a Wuhan Institute of Virology. That's a picture of it. All right, this is a level 4 secure facility. So there's different levels of security with these biotech labs. And so the level 4 is the ones that deal with the really scary stuff. So Ebola and the stuff you don't want to get out, right? And so of course you're going to stick it in the middle of a giant city, right? It's insane. Why is this in Wuhan? I don't know. Okay, but it is. That's where it is. So we know that. We know that scientists there were dealing with the bats that this coronavirus clearly is related to. The type of virus that we know is native to these particular bats, and that the bats aren't from this part of China. So the bats would have had to fly hundreds of miles away, right? A bat rancher went to the caves and then brought them to the wet market. I mean, you can see how it's just immediately the mind, you don't know for sure, but you think, surely the lab leak is a reasonable thing to investigate. And the fact that you're telling me we're not allowed to makes me think we really should investigate it, right? So this is what we were dealing with. And so we know that they used these bats. We knew fairly quickly that there was funding. We didn't know what we know now, but we knew even 6 or 9 months ago that there was funding for so-called gain-of-function research going on in this lab. And then especially telling, the U.S. State Department had issued a report in 2020 telling the U.S. government, we're concerned about the security protocols at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We knew that. We knew it when the book was written, during the lockdowns. So this was not new stuff. What we did not know at the time is there's not enough when you analyze the virus to be able to say, okay, is this natural or is it man-made? And part of the problem, I can tell you, that made this debate difficult, is that people wanted to believe the most outlandish thing, right? So here's the thing, when you're considering hypotheses, right? Considering different ways of explaining some event, right? And so let's say you did something kind of dastardly, right? And you don't want people to know that. You want them to believe something else. One way you could throw them off the scent is to get them to believe something even more outrageous, right? So let's say you were engaged in gain-of-function research. And what that means is, it's sort of like, let's say you're a dog breeder, right? So you're not literally manipulating proteins and DNA. That's what people often think. They think this is an engineered and manufactured thing. It's like this Frankenstein bug. We don't know how to do that, really. What we could do is you could take a viral culture, and you have billions of them, and you find mutant varieties, and then you preserve the mutant varieties, right? And then you let those reproduce, and then you find another mutant variety, and you preserve that, just like you do with dog breeding or with cattle breeding, right? In which you're not saying, oh, I want a cow with blue eyes, and so you turn a button, right? The cow's with blue eyes. That's not how it works. You're guiding this kind of natural process of mutation toward a particular end. All right, and so that's the kind of thing. But what you'd want, if you say, let's say you were doing that, and let's say you're a U.S. government official that had funded this research for hundreds of millions of dollars for years, and were on video defending it, what would you want people to say? Well, okay, we'll try to get them to buy the wet market story. Now, this is my speculation, right? I'm just kind of spinning a story here. You'd like them to believe, okay, this is an engineered biovirus that the Chinese intentionally released to kill everybody, right? Get them focused on that, and then hopefully they won't notice this thing, which is probably what actually happened, right? And so the debate was either it's natural or it is this Frankenstein bug that was bioengineered as a bioweapon and the Chinese intentionally released it. But notice there's this other hypothesis right here, which is that it was natural, but it's the subject of gain-of-function experiments to make it more infectious for human beings. And you do that not to kill people. You do that because you think this could eventually happen naturally. So you have this bat coronavirus that humans can't be infected with. But if it mutates in a certain way, it could eventually pass over and then be dangerous to human beings. So you say, okay, well, that could eventually happen, so let's do that in the lab. Let's speed that up. We'll develop and we'll test and we'll see, okay, is this as it gets closer and closer to infectiousness for humans, that's gain of function. It's a gain of lethality in infectiousness. Does this make sense? All right, and so if you get it there, now why would you do that? What would be the benevolent reason for doing that? So that you can develop vaccines ahead of time, all right? So you basically anticipate what might happen in nature ahead of time. You've got a vaccine and you've got it in a freezer somewhere, and then when it actually happens in nature, boom, 2 months, you've got the vaccine. So that's the reason to do that. Right? Now the problem is, that is dangerous, right? But whatever argument you want to have, whether it's wise or not, that is a really dangerous thing to do, and you want to make sure if you're going to do it that the lab is locked down tight. It's probably not in China in the middle of a city, right? So that's where we are. That's what we think probably happened. I can't prove that. When the book was written, we thought, we can't tell if this is natural or was the result of gain of function, so we said at the time, so far as we know, it's natural, but we're pretty sure it came from the lab. Since then, there have now been tens of thousands of attempts to find precursor viruses. So you got the bat virus over here, and so let's say there's five changes that I'm just making that up, five changes that need to be made to make it infectious to humans. If that happened in nature, you're going to find it out there in the world. You're going to find these missing links. Well, we've done tens of thousands of those, and in other cases, with a natural virus that jumps, you find those missing links. There aren't any. And so this is why, finally, the dam broke a few months ago, and people were willing to say, okay, it's probably a lab leak. And so now what's going to happen is that we're going to have probably a year of chasing down who funded this, who knew, who covered it up, why did they cover it up, and so forth. All right. A bunch of you probably suspected something like this at the beginning and were told you were crazy for thinking it. So I tell you all that just to dignify that intuition that you may have had. All right. So that was all back there. So I've gone and filled you in on the stuff that was just a worry initially. Right. Then there's that crummy computer model that I told you about. Right. So here's the guy. His name is Neil Ferguson from the Imperial College London, who has a perfect record for predictive models going back 20 years. He has never gotten it right once. And so we list this, and you want to see him in the book. I mean, bugs that he said 200 million people that were going to die and 100 people died. I mean, that's off that much. He never suffered any consequences or negative consequences to his career until he was caught during the lockdown in London sneaking across town to see his mistress. So it's funny what takes people down, right? It wasn't the fact that he totally messed this up. And so his prediction, if you remember, was that 40 million people would die within a few months, including 2.2 million Americans, unless lockdowns and other non-pharmacological interventions were done, right? So that's where that number came from. Now, how did he get that number? He got that number by plugging in an infection fatality rate for the virus of 3.4%, which would have made it much more deadly than the Spanish flu. He doesn't have any basis for this at all, but you generate that number, it's plugged in. Everyone bought it, including the head of the World Health Organization, President Trump's key advisors. That the number was out there and the decisions were made before they finally released the model for public viewing. And they, so they fiddled with it for a month. So any of you that know anything about computer modeling, so it was written in Fortran, this old computer language. It was so buggy that every time they would run it, it would do something different. And so they spent a month prettying it up, and then finally some engineers from Microsoft and different places got to look at it. And this is my favorite quote from a guy at Microsoft. So when they looked at it, it was a buggy mess that looks more like a bowl of angel hair pasta than a finely tuned piece of programming. All right? That's the model. A single model. Now, there are others at the University of Washington and at Johns Hopkins, but this is the one that the head of the World Health Organization heard about and believed and transmitted to the other heads of public health entities in the country. So that's a biggie. By the way, the infection fatality rate, the real one, is between 0.15 and 0.26%, not 3.4%. And there's the global technocrat. So this is Director General Tedros of the World Health Organization. Now, the World Health Organization is the public health arm of the United Nations. It was formed with the UN Charter in 1948. It has all of its credibility because it happened to come online just as we were trying to get the smallpox virus around the world. And it succeeded in doing that. It succeeded spectacularly. And so it has that kind of credibility. Now, who is Tedros? Tedros is a longtime member of the Ethno-Nationalist Communist Party of Ethiopia. All right? Not making it up. So when you hear this, you think, okay, what conspiracy site is he reading? It's Wikipedia, I promise. You can look this up. So he was a government official in the Tigrayan People's Party of Ethiopia, which has been accused of all sorts of human rights atrocities and violations. He's a malaria expert, served in the communist government in Ethiopia, and was the number one choice of the People's Republic of China to ascend to the top post in 2017. So he's the head public health bureaucrat on the planet. All right, now what's funny about him is there's an American, Chinese-American analyst named Gordon Chang, and this is what he said about Tedros. He said, Tedros is the second to the last person who should be heading the World Health Organization at this time. The second to the last. And so who's the last person? He said, the last person is Xi Jinping. So that's the president of China, right? So this is like the second to the last guy that you'd actually want. And as we learned very early on, even the Atlantic magazine said that Tedros seemed to be carrying water for Beijing, for the communists in China. Very specifically doing things, including initially saying that the virus was of no risk to anyone, including saying that it could not be transmitted from human to human, when he knew that it could be, when the Chinese knew for weeks that it could be, and there was a precious 6 weeks of time that he was basically covering for these people. So this is kind of weird, right? A single computer model, a single guy. He has a degree in malarial infection, so he is a malarial expert, which is a parasite. I don't think he's a physician. I think he's a infectious disease expert. So who are the two very smart people? Because y'all may remember in April when President Trump, President Trump had these sort of instincts, but he also had public health officials that he inherited from the administrative state and didn't come into office as an expert in infectious disease, right? So what do? Well, you have these people, and he sort of asked them, and so he said on a press conference on April the 8th of 2020, and why did you suggest something like lockdowns? I mean, why did you say we need to be kind of full steam ahead on this stuff? And here's what he said. The big projection being that 2.2 million people would die if we did nothing. That was another decision we made. Close it up. That was a big decision that we made. Two very smart people walked into my office and said, listen, these are your alternatives. And that was a projection of 1.5 to 2.2 million people would die if we didn't close it up. 2.2 million, right? So two people. We know one was Anthony Fauci, We're certain it was not, the other one was not Deborah Birch, and so I've not been able to figure out who the other person was. If I had to guess, now this is just my guess, it was Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins, the head of the NIH, that told him this. They're smart, that's two people, and they seem like the obvious people to tell him this. So in other words, right now these are smart guys. They said the same thing that Tedros said, and Tedros got his information from a computer model that was a buggy mess of angel hair pasta. Right? That is frightening. Now, this is only possible because what's happened since World War II is a massive buildup of this public health bureaucracy, both globally and nationally. And that's the kind of basic reality that we're dealing with. And so when you take that, and then you add the effect of the media that we'll talk about tomorrow, what you have is the makings of a planet-wide social contagion based upon the decisions of, you know, in a sense, about six or eight people that are just very, very well placed. That's utterly terrifying. And tomorrow we will talk more about the story, but with that I'll stop and we'll take some time for questions.